Today on How to Save Democracy, we're going to share an episode of another podcast that I was recently a guest on. Double Take Debate is a new current affairs podcast hosted by comedian and political commentator Robin Clavan. Each episode pits two guests with very different views against each other in front of a live audience in a cocktail bar in London. Robin and the team invited me to join a debate about how to save British democracy in the face of the increasing threat of a reform-led government. I hope you enjoy. We'll be back with more episodes soon.
Whoa! We're alive! Woo!
And the question we're asking today is how to save democracy and stop reform.
Yes.
So the phrase
democracy. Is that the right noise?
Yeah,
I'm
think
not
it's
sure.
Yeah, you can respond however feels honest to you. So according to you, Garth, if an election was held tomorrow, we'd have a hung parliament with Reform as the biggest party. According to the Democracy Index, only 25% of the world's countries are full and functioning democracies. They don't currently include the USA. Democracy, we maybe take for granted as a kind of predisposition of humanity, but democracies are historically very rare. They've existed for moments in the 20th century, although universal suffrage hasn't existed in a lot of European countries for more than 100 years, and even full female suffrage in a lot of European countries didn't happen until the 1970s. So democracies are perhaps a lot more precarious than we assumed and a lot more historically contingent than we hoped. They are fragile. And so the urgent question we're asking is how to save them, and specifically in the context of the UK, how to battle a possible threat to democracy, reform. Whether or not they're a threat to democracy, we can get into, but I'd argue they are. Joining me are two very capable guests. Please give a very warm welcome to Matthew Torbit and John Alexander. Matthew Torbit is a former advisor to the Labour Party, or a number of Labour politicians, and is a political commentator who campaigns on social issues, economic redistribution, and specifically around homelessness and regenerating the north of England. Would you say that's fair, Matthew?
I think that's fair, yeah.
That's great. Thank you. Thank you for dressing so smartly.
Just for you guys.
Just
you know that.
He was in his PJs before he came.
I appreciate the respect. And John Alexander is the author of Citizens, a Campaigner for Direct Democracy, and is about to begin a fellowship at Harvard at the Center for Democratic Innovation. So we're going to have two views.
No noises for that.
No noises. Come on.
I'm pretty chuffed with that, all right? Come on.
It's the British thing. If you, even in America, if you go to Harvard, they're like, yes. If you do it in Britain, they're like, you posh wanker. They're like, all right, would you like a Vol-au-Vent? Yes. Great. So welcome, John and Matthew. Thank you so much for joining us. Who thinks democracy is genuinely in peril in this country? Put your hands in the air. Okay, so that's almost all of the room, I'd say. There are a few people who are really confident about the future. Who thinks that democracy can survive in its current form, in first past the post, in Westminster, in the current mechanics that we have? Can democracy survive in that form? Please put your hand in the air. This is just me telling you what to do rather than voting myself. Who thinks that we need a radical rethink of the relationship between the state and people in order for it to survive? That's most of the room. Okay. And even Matthew, who's arguing against that, sort of agrees. So, yeah, he's voting for all three. Yeah. And I suppose we're going to have two distinct views here. Probably there may well be some overlap. And we're going to start with you, Matthew.
I think there is a short-term answer and a more long-term answer for the preservation of democracy, regardless of whoever's in power, because I think it is under threat. We've seen it in recent polls that Gen Z is at a third, would much rather a strong leader to get stuff done. So I think the long-term plan is economic, geographical redistribution. But where we have gone wrong for essentially 40 years in prioritising London and the South East, and I'm happy to bore you with the facts of that, and that totally plays into the fact that those that do feel left behind, and I know it's a sort of Westminster cliche and all the rest of it, but those that did, when they were given the opportunity to give quote unquote the elites a bit of a kick in, they did so. And that should have been a wake up call to all those within Westminster and in and around Whitehall. We need to change maybe the way we've been doing things, and they haven't. And therefore we now see the sort of evil baby of Brexit now in as Nigel Farage MP, who has totally, you know, not taken any blame for Brexit whatsoever, despite being the architect for it, potentially ending up Prime Minister with a 22% mandate, which is not healthy for democracy at all.
Yeah, John, what would really make a difference here?
I mean, I guess the very top line is I think it's not the economy. It's the power, and the two things are related. But when you purely focus on economic policy, you leave yourself in a place where you're trying to do things for people. And the power actually remains generally pretty centralised. The decisions are made away, and actually it's not the material conditions. The assumption that's at the heart of that is this idea that people are consumers. People are narrowly self-interested, materialistic creatures, and you need to increase material standards of living in order to satisfy their basic humanity, because that is your conception of their basic humanity. And that's fundamentally flawed. Like, people are creatures who need meaning, and people need to matter. One of the things I did in the research for my book is I went a little way into the QAnon conspiracy theory world. I emphasise a little way. Don't worry. So this is the conspiracy theory that led to the 2021 January Capitol riots and the sort of claim. And they believe that sort of the Democrats are a kind of baby-eating circle of doom. Like, it's pretty nuts stuff. The entry gateway into the QAnon conspiracy theory is basically, you're needed here. Here is your first task. We cannot save this country without you. You have a role to play. And this is an incredibly powerful invite to people who have basically been treated as if they are a problem to be managed, actually. What we need in this moment is to open up our institutions so that they tap into the ideas and energy and resources of everyone. Because if we don't do that, we are telling them that we will do for them, and that is pushing them into the arms of fascism. I think my very short headline is, we open up our institutions or they die.
Yeah. And what that means to you, John, is citizens' assemblies, it's putting power back into communities, and there's a whole kind of system of research-based mechanisms that I'm sure you have examples of that fundamentally change how we run a democratic system and re-energise it.
Yeah, I mean, if I give one example just to sort of illustrate, I'd love to contrast the Brexit process, which we've sort of brought into the room, and kind of has to be in the room with reform, right? Like, as you say, it's directly the child of where we are now is directly the child of that moment in this country, at least, with the Irish referendum on abortion 2 years later. So what happened in Brexit was that people were essentially offered two shit options that they had no real agency in shaping either of, and someone said that one was taking back control, which I think is language we should come back to. Like, this idea of power is what was arguably on offer, rather than, it wasn't a material pitch, and they chose what many of us would argue as the worst one, and then it was just sort of, that was that. It was like, I would describe that actually as a kind of consumer choice. It's consumer politics. Give people a fixed set of options they've had no agency in creating, and that's it. Whereas in Ireland, the legislative proposal to legalise access to abortion up to 12 weeks, which went to referendum in May 2018, passed with 66% majority. That proposal was formed by a citizens' assembly. So 99 randomly selected Irish citizens brought together for 5 weekends over 5 months to deliberate on the options, hear witnesses from all sides of the debate. And then when that they sort of came by consensus to that proposal to legalise access to abortion up to 12 weeks, when that was then put to referendum, the
the process was fundamentally different, that the nature of the conversation was fundamentally different. So a referendum process that actually brought people together and healed an age-old trauma. I get too overexcited by this, and but like those assemblies are one example of a process. Yeah. They are not the whole of this.
Another interpretation of Brexit, there's this one about control. But the other argument that's sometimes weaponized is people didn't feel like they were having social needs met.
I feel that we essentially live in two Englands at the moment. We have London, and then we have provincial England. We have a model that we can follow. So 1992, when the Berlin Wall fell, and there was a reunification, Germany, as it became, repurposed what they have as the KfW, which was set up post-World War II to basically help East Germany get to the point where West Germany was. The KfW did things through a solidarity tax where the West would give part of their income to the East. For 30 years they did this. 2022, they should have carried on for another 10 years. It would have been a success. They consider it a failure because it's now 85% productivity compared to the West. That to me is a miracle, essentially, in 30 years. Incredible. They consider it a failure. What we've done over 40 years is not invest in the North, not invest in the Midlands, anywhere north of Birmingham. And this is partly down to the Treasury and the way that the Treasury is essentially a Victorian-level system that still sees itself as protecting waste of taxpayers' money.
Isn't there kind of an expectation problem with your argument as well, in the sense that people, in order to fund the projects that you're talking about, I mean, I'm presuming it's government investment, then we need to make an argument for taxation, and there's not really a public appetite for that at the moment. And there's not enough bold storytelling within the Labour Party or within any progressive movement that says, hey, if this is the vision we want, a shared future with jobs, with investment, then someone's going to have to pay for it, and that does mean higher taxes. And at the moment, most parties are being skewered by promising too much and then under-delivering. And so, I mean, the challenge with your point is, like, who's going to make that case? You are, apparently. But is that what you're arguing for? A party to take power that can argue the progressive case for high taxation and redistribution through infrastructure investment in the North?
Not necessarily. If you look at the KfW, right, it was able to borrow at high rates because it borrowed under the auspices of the KfW, not as Germany. This should really be a Bank of England issue, by the way, not necessarily government, but neither of them want to do it. I think what you need is better messengers. At the moment, the Labour Party, you know, I'm sure many people agree, are not blessed with many good messengers. And this is not going to happen under Keir Starmer and Rachel Reeves. Now, if an Andy Burnham came into the picture, who has gone from a middling Blairite minister to going and learning a lot being Mayor of Greater Manchester, and through his own experience can make the case of, for me, every region in this country needs a capital.
Actually, I don't think we're, like, in some ways, opposed. Like, I think there's a very
John,
different
I want
debate.
I want a
debate.
Reductive binary.
Reductive binary. But I think there is a very different emphasis. This sort of power versus
economics.
Power versus economics, and where you choose to place the emphasis is really significant. And maybe just to bring this alive a bit, I kind of want to zoom out slightly because we tend to sort of think about. These conversations often happen as if the UK is the only place this shit is going down, right? And there was an economist poll of polls across 27 European nations and the Scandies and a few others. I think there were like 33 nations included in it that showed that for the first time, actually, the far right parties are polling higher than any other political grouping. And that has never happened. That didn't even happen in the 1930s. Right, and so my argument is really that there is something actually much more fundamental going on, that we are in a kind of epochal moment, right? Like, so end of the 90s. So in my work, I talk about seeing the moment in time we're living in through the lens of what I call stories of self and society. So I talk about subject, consumer, and citizen as three stories of the individual in society. Very briefly, end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th, the dominant story is the subject. So the right thing to do, keep your head down, do as you're told. There are a God-given few who know best. They will run society for the best interests of everyone, and therefore the rest of us just shut the fuck up. That story kind of fell apart end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th, because of industrial revolution, rise of the middle class. You just couldn't sustain that. Out of the two world wars, we then built what I call the consumer story. And this was a logic that said, actually, growth is good. Like, economics is the answer to everything. GDP was first conceived in 1937, right? Like, and by the way, the guy who first conceived it said, never use this as a measure of national success. But anyway, we'll come back to that. But the consumer story is constructed out of this idea that if everyone pursues their own in their own material self-interest, then that will add up to the collective interest. That's how the best society will result. The Milton Friedman thing, the social responsibility of business is to maximize its profits, is a moral statement. It's a statement about how the best thing happens. And that story has had us for 80 years, and now it's fucked, right? And the problem, the deeper problem, is you can't solve the challenges of our time from within that logic, because the logic created them. You can't solve loneliness and mental ill health from within a story that says we're independent, isolated individuals. You can't solve inequality from within a story that says that competition is what fixes everything and raises the standards. It created the crisis. And you, most fundamentally, and what I, when I hear some of these things about we need more airports and that kind of shit, sorry, excuse my language, but you can't solve an ecological crisis, which we, like, seriously have, right, from within logic that says that, that success is material standards of living, we're separate from nature. And so we the story is collapsing. And what's happening, I think, is because all of our kind of mainstream parties, all of our mainstream political logics are born out of that story, out of what's being called deliverism, which I would suggest is some of what, not all of what you're talking from, but some of it. That logic simply can't work, and no one believes it anymore. And so you end up with people, like, the way I would argue it is you're in a situation where people are being offered stick or twist, where stick is manifestly fucked and twist is fascism. Mm-hmm. Twist is back to the subject story. And actually, there's a whole other thing going on, and it's not just assemblies. It's community power. It's community land trusts and community energy. And it's people being the solutions to their own challenges at every scale and every level in a way that is not just a cute exception. It's proper meaningful. And that is a logic that I think I call the citizen story. And so for that, the logic there is not keep your head down, do as you're told. It's not pursue self-interest and that will magically add up. It's get involved. It's contribute your ideas, energy and resources to the pursuit of the best outcomes. And it's open up our institutions or create new ones if we have to. Because there is, all of us are smarter than any of us, is the only logic that can actually face these challenges.
And before we kind of get back, and I want to get some examples from you and then go to you as well, Matthew, could I not just push back a bit and say that actually the problem that you're describing and that we're in of this lack of powerlessness, etc., that's a problem of just the stage of capitalism that we're in. And to go back to your point, you know, the West won the Cold War, half the world was opened up to the markets of capitalism. That meant that this kind of ravenous appetite of markets had a big burst of affluence that propelled in the West, in New Labour, it propelled a kind of a very economically successful government riding off the back of global markets. And we've run out of things to consume. Markets have turned back in on themselves. They're cannibalizing their assets. And what that means in a literal sense is that it's run out of any form of intellectual justification. People no longer can defend it because it's evidently not working. But that's an economic question. That, going back to Matthew's point, that's a question about how do we redistribute wealth and actually put money where we want to, rather than a democratic question.
But then my response to that is to go, that's so disempowering, right? Like that makes all of this a big out there thing about isms. And the joy of this work, I think, is that the joy I find in my work, let me say it like that, is that actually if we just see people slightly differently, you can do fundamentally different things.
There is that innate selfish nature of humans where they need a carrot and a stick.
Ha! Okay.
They do. I say as a socialist, right? But there's this innate thing where people become apathetic, and we see it borne out in studies and everything else. So I think for communities to thrive, you have to give them a reason to. Now, direct democracy may well be it. My concern is, maybe this is unfair, not using stats and using people I know, but it's what I know as well.
Real humans, they do it.
Yeah, no, I think of people like my parents. You know, they don't vote, they hate it all, they think everyone's against them and all the rest of it. For good reason, they've grown up 60 years with this sort of shit. I worry direct democracy for not everything or whatever it is you might be putting forward ends up like jury service. And you go, oh, fucking hell, I've got to go and vote on the bins and how often they're out. And that's to maybe belittle it slightly. That's not the intention. But it becomes a thing of, what's the point? What happens? And maybe they need to see it for themselves. I think that becomes easier if you give them that material thing. I think also we've got a hell of a task ahead of us to build communities back. They've been decimated by deindustrialization, and Thatcher's ghost still casts a shadow over all of us communities that have just been left to fester, and therefore see simple answers to complicated questions in people like Nigel Farage going, we're not going to have targets because governments never hit them. And he's dangerous because he's so clever and he knows exactly what he's doing.
Well, it does feel like we're kind of in a place, both in this country and in America, where trust in politicians is so low and so decimated that people will... authenticity looks like someone who's openly satirizing the office. You know, people vote for Trump because he's almost like a joke of a president. It's someone who will, like, do a crap in the White House. Do you know what I mean? They want to openly defile the institutions and act as an avatar for their anger. So that kind of anger and a kind of like deliberate defilement of the institutions, I suppose that's the question we're asking, isn't it? What do we do with all that anger? How do we meet it? Because a lot of it is out there. Because I think actually for a lot of people, the giving upness that you describe, the kind of, oh, well, politics isn't for me, that's a kind of, there's anger in there as well. There's a kind of it's an internal anger. It's kind of like a defeatism about the future, right?
Of course and, there is. Yeah. And listen, I'm angry. We will all be angry in this room. You have to be angry to take this sort of stuff on. I think part of it, again, not to be reductive, it comes back to messengers. How the fuck does a billionaire, 80-year-old man with fake tan on come across as more real and human than all of these politicians? That's the danger. It's totally ridiculous. Dave Chappelle did a famous stand-up where he said Donald Trump won because he laughed at what the elites were doing. Hillary made a whole point that he'd not paid his taxes, and he went, who pays all the taxes? And people laughed, but it's that thing of, why would we play by the rules? And that's where we've got ourselves. The thing is, with people like Farage, I think it'll churn him. He'll win. It'll churn him up, spit him back out. He's an older man anyway, and there'll be a chance to try and build back. But we've got to learn from mistakes made during Brexit, navel-gazing. People have to feel like their voices are heard, because they will channel their anger to a point where most people I hear now going, the same as with Brexit, well, it can't get any worse, can it? And the danger is, if people that don't have a lot materialistically go, well, I might as well gamble it, because the little I've got, if I lose all that, it can't get much worse. And that's what we saw with Brexit. And the sad reality is, for those that voted Brexit, it absolutely can.
I have to come in on the human nature thing, dude.
You can come in, John. I'm going to give you... We're just going to... After John, we're going to go to questions. So if you have any fermenting in your mind or building up within you...
Someone asked me about Taiwan.
Please, please do. So,
fucking great story, honestly.
Yeah. John, you're about to tell us about human nature.
So I started my career working in the advertising industry. The advertising industry is rooted in the fundamental idea that humans are consumers, and that they are self-interested. It's not true, right? It's just not a fact. The problem is that we surround ourselves with this idea and this messaging so constantly that it primes us. Humans are by nature, I would argue, collaborative, creative, caring creatures, but we are also storytelling and story-dwelling creatures. And we're surrounded so strongly by the story that we're consumers. There's estimates that the average young Gen Z is exposed to something like 10,000 commercial messages a day now. When we measure success of our society through consumer confidence, that's, again, like, your role is to shop. Like, when eat out to help out, like, what the actual fuck? And then this is the danger, because then this manifests in this thing of, like, we won't be able to do any of the power stuff until we've made sure the little people are all right. And I know, we're being very nice to, but to demonize the argument a little bit, I think it comes down to what comes first, the power or the economics, because I'm still in favor of the redistribution, but I think the power has to come first.
I know you're ready to go, John.
Yeah.
Just tell us what you mean precisely by that. I mean, you've mentioned citizens' assemblies, you've mentioned community. Can you just get into, like, what are the mechanics of that happening? What, if you were in power, would you do tomorrow to make that happen?
Let me take the energy. So I think probably the biggest missed opportunity has been this stuff about mission-led government. which Dharma briefly talked about, and then we've heard very little. Take that energy mission, which I hinted at, right? If you go, and you could do this for all sorts of things, but if you go, right, we're going to make Britain a clean power nation, we're going to need everyone involved if we're going to do that. And I would celebrate the launch of that at the Ambition Lawrence Weston, where they built the wind tower. I put loads of money behind community energy. I create a randomly selected citizens panel as part of the accountability and governance structure of that mission. I would see.
Yeah, that's just so, because people might not know, and I just want to dig into some of what those mechanisms very quickly are of like a citizens panel. So there's rotation, there's random selection, yeah. And people in small groups consider information together, and they kind of statistically come up, as you mentioned with Ireland, with more progressive, more nuanced conclusions. And it's a kind of antidote, right? I think this is your argument. It's an antidote to, like, sometimes, particularly in London, the metropolitan elite or discussing art in a basement or whatever, you can be quite dismissive about people. Or there's an idea of, oh, people read tabloids and they're populist. It can be quite, you know, patronizing. But actually, the kind of citizens' assembly are an antidote to that. They say the opposite is true. When you give people power, when you take away the media lens, and when you put them in small groups, they don't become prejudiced, nasty people as they were shown in the Brexit referendum, they actually become more nuanced and have thoughtful decisions. So that's kind of the thrust of the point there, isn't it? Yeah, yeah. And it's happened in loads of different places. I mean, I've got examples here. Bogota, Colombia, for urban planning focus, Ireland Citizens Assemblies. We've got stuff in the Gambia, lots of things in, and Taiwan, as you mentioned.
Paris now has a standing citizens council as part of its governance structure. 100 randomly selected people represented the city population on all key demographics as effectively like the upper the House of Lords of Paris. They are on an 18-month rotation. They set the theme for 100 million euros a year of participatory budgeting. They can commission citizens' inquiries into key policy areas. There's like that, and that is why Hidalgo has managed to transform Paris, I would argue, some of all the car use and this kind of stuff. Because people, like, the response to the far right that comes from this kind of work is going, all right, you reckon that it's about, like, that the elites are fucked? Yeah, actually. And the answer, like, are you going to involve everyone then? Because we are. Like, we're gonna say, let's do this together, rather than we'll do it for you.
Can I just ask, because I'm not against citizens' assemblies, as I said, where does the democratic accountability come in? And there's two strands to that for me, because at the moment, you can pick people that are representative. I don't know how that happens, truth be told. But at the moment, the polls would tell us a lot of those people may actually be far right. Therefore, that you may not, I think they work and they are favourable to people like me and no doubt you when we come up with progressive policies. What about when they don't? And also, if things go wrong with that policy, who's accountable? Is it the Prime Minister for enacting what citizens have asked? And therefore, why is that fair? Because you lot wanted it. So what are you all blaming me for now, sort of thing? So I'm just trying to understand it a bit more.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the first point in my brain has just eroded for the second one.
What if we don't get as progressive and nice things as we would like? Because at the moment, the country may or may not be in a very progressive place.
I mean, the first thing I would say on that is, if you actually look at the data on the percentage of there was an amazing data February this year across 20 different policy issues, the percentage of people who said none of the above was more than double that for pretty much any of the parties. And if you add none of the above and don't know, it was sometimes as many as four times that for any of the parties. So most of this country is in a kind of a plague on all their houses, including reform. Reform are just set to be the beneficiary of that plague on all their houses rather than people being anti.
And in a strange way, that kind of it comes back to kind of Nelly, the point that Nelly was making in the previous debate, and the point that you make is that for bad things to happen, for fascism to happen, all that you actually need is for people to say, oh, well, I'm quite pissed off and I might try this. You know, it can be very banal. Well, you can go down a path that seems incredibly ordinary, yeah.
Yeah, and my concern is history teaches us a lot and history tends to repeat itself. And what we always see, 1930s and before, is that the far right do very well in times of economic crisis. And that's, for me, why the material is so important, because if people feel slightly better off, they probably don't mind that brown family at the end of the road moving in, even less so. Whereas if there is an assumption, which Nigel Farage has cultivated very well, that there is some level of skipping the queue, which we had in the early noughties, and David Blunkett kept going on about it and whatever else, then that resentment fosters, and therefore you lose community as well, and that's the nightmare of it.
Okay, we're going to go to some audience questions.
One of the big threats to our democracy at the moment is politics becoming increasingly seen as entertainment and just a lack of seriousness. Like, the two sides that you're arguing don't need to be mutually exclusive. There's, like, we need to take politicians seriously as, like, intelligent political actors, and we need to have those politicians, and we also need to take ourselves seriously as people who can actively participate and not just choose but also like affect things through our actions in our communities.
Hear, hear.
I disagree.
Hear, hear, but John disagrees. John, just give us a very quick reason why you disagree.
I mean, it's the Taiwan story, the Taiwan crowdsourcing.
He's desperate to get these in. Didn't even ask.
Can I go?
Just, yes, you can go. Be quick though, version. John.
Okay.
So I love
Taiwan,
how excited you get.
Taiwan crowdsourced their national COVID response, right? With the three design principles, and this is why it is actually an answer to your question, not just the massive force. The three design principles they publicly announced were fast, fair, and fun for the national COVID response. They set challenge prizes where people could work to get tech community to create apps that would track face mask availability in case outbreaks and this kind of thing. But they also did like load of joyful stuff. Like, my favorite story within the story is they set up a phone line where anyone could ring in with ideas for how the country's response could be better. And a little boy rang up and said, the boys in my class don't want to wear their face masks because they're pink and they think that they're girly. So you should do something to make pink face masks cool, and I think you should work with the baseball team. 3 days later, they had half the Taiwanese baseball team, the little boy and the president, on the national televised press conference in pink face masks. This set off a wave of pink is cool memes across the country. They even brought Pink Panther back onto primetime TV. This is all fucking true,
but
right?
John, we live in a country of Boaty McBoatface.
Ah! No, but this is exactly it. If you make participation trivial, then people take the piss out of it.
But isn't that, aren't you agreeing with Polly's point in the corner then, that it's about seriousness and about taking ourselves seriously? So
to a degree.
Are you agreeing, or are you just trying to get a point in about Taiwan?
I guess what I'm saying is, serious maybe, but it also has to be joyful, right? Like, the thing about this stuff, and assemblies and these kinds of things, and I'm really wary of this all being reduced back to citizens' assemblies, as hopefully you can tell. They are important, but they're not the whole. But the core principle of it has to be, like, the joy of figuring out how to do life together is huge. And we're fucking deprived of that, because only a tiny proportion of people have any agency over the decision-making.
I want to give a question with a quick reference to Kenya. So Kenya in 2010 brought in a new constitution, and in it they enshrined public participation. And the courts now have to interpret what that means, and the courts come down on local governments that don't do it properly. And there's even the County Climate Change Fund, which doesn't just consult people, it gives people the money. It says, here's a community committee, here's a load of money, you decide what you want to do with it to deal with climate change. But it took to get there 1,000 people to get killed in riots and regular election cycles of riots and people getting killed. So my question is, what's it going to take in this country, do you think, to institutionalize public participation in that way?
Boom.
I mean, I guess I'll do the shortest answer
Please
I've done
do.
All evening.
Please do.
I mean, I think it can be the work of a moment. That's why I told the story about the riots. Like, if Starmer had done the speech that fucking wrote itself, I was in tears the next morning with how he did it, then you change the story in a moment and you create the space. I don't think it has to be. And look, remember COVID, we had the NHS first responder thing, 750,000, designed for 250,000 people to sign up in 3 weeks, 750 signed up in 750,000 in 36 hours, crashed the website. Like, we keep having these moments when we could open this up. Well, and we don't.
And I do think that Britain as a country in some ways is crying out for a narrative of like duty and civic contribution. Like, it seems to be in our DNA. It seems to be something that Britain really likes. That's why kind of World War II has this great reverence and this strange you know, paradox, where a time that was, to your point, John, and maybe I don't know how you'd respond to this, Matthew, a time of like incredible material deprivation, grief, sadness, and struggle, but is mythologized because it had a collective purpose. And we think back on that as a time of meaning and a time of national story, because maybe life at the moment, that the stories that we're telling are kind of old echoes of the past rather than new ones about civic duty and purpose that Britain could have. But I'm ranting and I'm the host. Matthew, yeah, you go, because I've been neglecting you.
That's okay. I'm used to it.
It's from Stockport.
See, that's how you win the crowd over. Make sure you vote later.
The thing that worries me about things like, and I know we keep coming back to citizens' assemblies, but any sort of attempt at direct democracy is, and the seriousness aspect, is we have a deeply unserious media. So you know for a fact, the Daily Mail will trawl through any fucker that's on a citizen assembly and go, there's a tenuous link because they were at university with Keir Starmer, so they're clearly a Marxist. George Soros has somehow put some money in somewhere, so all of a sudden it's a conspiracy. And you can see it all now. And what you end up is with the public hating the public, which is a very dangerous situation. I've probably played my part in the unseriousness of politics to my shame, because I feel that's the moment we're living in. I remember feeling deeply sorry for Kamala Harris, who I think was shat on by Joe Biden and his team and given 90 days to try and run a presidential campaign. I think she's brilliant in that time for what she could do. And I remember thinking, how do you beat people like Trump? We need to entertain at the moment. And the best thing I could come up with is we need to put the rock up. And I don't know how we get back to the seriousness.
Chicken and egg, isn't it? Because politics at the moment is so toxic, so violent, that actually it's such a high bar of thick-skinnedness to get into it. And actually it doesn't seem to be delivering on change. So it's not attracting good people who feel like they can deliver on change because it doesn't have that environment. So the first task, I think, is to stand up for politicians. Like most politicians who get into power do it for good reasons, and they want to change the world for some benefit. And the Labour Party at the moment, as much as they may be staggering around, a lot of them have personal stories about why they're there and why they want to change the world or lift people out of poverty. So there needs to be, in some ways, some kind of robust defence of a political class. So it's an attractive thing to do, rather than everyone going, well, they're a bunch of wankers and Westminster's fucked.
It's a shit job and it's a shit life. You know, me and my partner, I had political ambitions a long time ago. I think I will support her in whatever she wants to do, if that's something she wants to do eventually. You're away from home 4 nights a week. This is why they all go off and have affairs and everything else, right? You get death threats every day of the week. 50% of people on Twitter think you're a cunt. The other 50% think you're the best thing since sliced bread. I always say, don't read it, because you're going to get either think you're great and you're not, you're deeply average, and or two, you're going to want to string yourself up because people are awful. And in a way, MPs haven't helped themselves. People where I'm from, the people who are totally disengaged with politics, think all MPs are millionaires, liars, pedos, sex pests, and on the take. Now, every stereotype in life has a kernel of truth, and that is part of the problem. The idea of a politician's answer and not answering a question properly, that they're all on the take because we've had the expenses scandal still in living memory. So, and actually, to quote, which won't go down well with this vote coming up, something Dominic Cummings said to me, who I actually think, despite his eugenicist tendencies.
That's a big caveat.
Yes, big caveat. A very big one.
Oh, God.
He said, you all need to get out of London and you might really know what's going on. That is absolutely true. And we saw that borne out with the 2019 election. And the other thing he said to me the other week, I met him for a coffee and I'm eager to learn from all manner of morons and geniuses. He said, is it what we need, better elites? And maybe that comes back to the series. because you're not going to get rid of the people in Westminster. Oh, good. I've ruined that now, haven't I?
Well, we're out of time. we could have just locked the doors and talked about Dominic coming for the next 4 hours. Things could have got weird. Thank you so much for your time, beautiful people. Give yourself a round of applause. We're going to vote, and as Matthew said, he perhaps ended on a note that would alienate you all. But remember, previously he did express vulnerability as a tactic to also get your vote. So hold those two things in your mind. I'm going to vote for Matthew first. Matthew is crystallising a vision of economic redistribution across the UK. That should be our priority to save democracy. If you agree, put your hand in the air and cheer now. Yay! It's pretty good. John, John is arguing for community-led citizens' assemblies and other forms of direct democracy, opening up the institutions so they can survive. I think John deserves it. Woo! Matthew deserves it. Woo! Oh, Christ. That's too close to call. You can decide.
No.
It's a citizens' assembly. It's a citizens' assembly. We're just going to go to the next person. We're randomly... shut up, Nelly. Get a grip, Nelly. This is why not. Why can't everyone win? Okay, guys, everyone's won. Apart from... Who's won? It's fine. No one cares. Guys, why am I... I'm like a terrible political elite, just kind of obsessed with trying to get a binary referendum from the people. I need to learn from you guys. Thank you so much for watching.
How to Save Democracy is produced in partnership with The Conduit and wouldn't be possible without the kind support of Open Society Foundations and you, our listeners. We've got big plans, so if you can chip in to help us make them happen, we'd love to have you on board.